This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
At the start of the year, Rishi Sunak set out five priorities. One of them was to pass new laws to stop small boats, making sure that if you come to this country illegally, you're detained and swiftly removed. But it's not proving straightforward. Last summer, a government plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda was stopped at the 11th hour when the European Court of Human Rights issued an injunction. That intervention didn't go down very well with some Conservative MPs. And last week, when asked about it, Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick refused to rule out withdrawing from the ECHR, saying the government would do whatever is necessary ultimately to defend our borders. So, what is the European Court on Human Rights? How does it work? What would happen if we left it? And are we likely to? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is the ECHR and where did it come from? Dr. Ed Bates is Professor of Law at Leicester University and author of The Evolution of the European Convention on Human Rights. Ed Bates, let's start with the absolute basics. What is the ECHR?
Well, the ECHR is an international agreement, a treaty opened for signature in 1950. There are 46 states to it today, but it started with just a dozen or so. It's the product of an international organisation, the Council of Europe, which was established in 1949. And the ECHR establishes the European Court of Human Rights. That's based in Strasbourg in France. It's a completely different institution then to the Court of Justice of the EU, which is based in Luxembourg. People often confuse the two. Now, as we know, the UK has left the EU, so it's no longer subject to the jurisdiction of the Luxembourg Court. However, Brexit had no bearing on the UK's membership of the ECHR, so the UK remained subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights.
How involved was the United Kingdom in the drafting of the original convention?
The UK had a major influence on the drafting of the convention. It was regarded as the home of the common law and the home of the protection of human rights, so it had a very high regard at Strasbourg when the convention was being drafted. The biggest influence that the UK had in relation to the drafting of the convention was actually to ensure that there were qualifications to those human rights, and furthermore, that the enforceability of the convention at the time of its drafting was weakened. So the British were very keen to ensure that there wouldn't actually be compulsorily a European Court of Human Rights or the right of individuals to access the court. The UK was very sovereignty conscious at this stage, one might say. And there are various reasons for that. One might interpret some of the records today as a quite a high level of constitutional arrogance. The UK didn't want some unknown foreign court meddling into human rights of the UK. What on earth would happen then? Equally, the UK was a colonial power in the late 1940s. So there was a great sense of awareness that human rights were being drafted for the UK, say, and issues could arise in relation to the colonies, for example, the right to freedom of elections. So, yes, there were great concern at Whitehall about the potential meddling and awkward influence of the European Court of Human Rights were it to come into being in later years.
Let's talk about what rights and freedoms it protected.
The European nations in establishing the convention were keen to protect civil and political rights, in particular the first order human rights as they saw them. That's freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, right to fair trial, plus rights relating to the protection of the integrity and security of individuals, the right to life, prohibition on torture, prohibition on slavery, for example. In addition, a few additional rights, such as the right to respect for private and family life and the right to marry, core human rights as we would see them today. Furthermore, if you look at the text of the convention, it's important to highlight the word everyone is used a lot. That is to say, everyone has the right to liberty. Everyone has the right to life. Criminals included, for example, even today, terrorists. Of course, the standards of protection might be adjusted to certain contexts there, but the drafters of the convention were clear that these civil and political rights, which the convention mainly protects, were for everyone.
When we signed the convention as the UK, did we also sign up at that point for the courts to enforce it?
No, that was an optional feature, if you like, of the convention of 1950. So the way it was set up was that there was provision made for a convention in 1950, but it was only ever going to come about if the required number of states agreed to accept its jurisdiction. It was eight. Now, by the mid-1960s, that number had been fulfilled. It was mainly the smaller states of Europe which had accepted the jurisdiction of the court. But in 1966, the UK joined them. It was the second major European power to do so after Germany. So it was a couple of decades later, really, that the European Court of Human Rights started to have an influence and an effect for the UK. And especially from the 1970s onwards, the first cases were going to Strasbourg and resulted in judgments delivered against the UK in matters such as prisoner rights, important rulings concerning Northern Ireland and treatment of individuals there verging on torture, although the court said it wasn't torture. This was the era when the Isle of Man wanted to retain judicial corporal punishment, birching, and the European Court of Human Rights said, no, that's not acceptable in the context of modern 20th century Europe. Other cases concerned same-sex relationships, which were criminalised in Northern Ireland, even if there was consent, and freedom of expression. There were a whole host of significant rulings from the late 1970s onwards from the European Court of Human Rights, exposing little fault lines, important issues relating to UK law, and demonstrating, therefore, that the UK's record in relation to human rights wasn't quite as good as it might have thought of been back in the 1950s.
Where does the UK's Human Rights Act fit in with the European Convention?
The Human Rights Act was the product of the new Labour government, its electoral victory of 1997. By the 1990s, the UK had been found in violation of the convention more than any other state, not in relation to major violations, with one or two exceptions. But the point about it was civil society was saying, why do individuals have to take their case to the European Court of Human Rights to assert these convention rights? The issue there was that individuals in the UK were unable to plead convention rights in domestic law prior to the Human Rights Act. The new Labour government under Tony Blair said rights should be brought home. The Human Rights Act requires Parliament to go through a process of ensuring that new laws are compatible with convention rights. But Parliament also isn't bound by the convention in that regard. It might be politically embarrassing if there's disagreement, but the capacity for that is a built-in feature of the Human Rights Act.
So one of the things you'd anticipate as a result of the Human Rights Act is that Britain would lose fewer cases, in fact have fewer cases, heard before the court in Strasbourg.
Absolutely. We see that the number of cases going to Strasbourg, especially over the last 10 years, has fallen dramatically.
So if we do end up with a case in front of the Strasbourg court, the European Court of Human Rights, and Britain loses it, are we forced to accept the judgment of the court or not?
The UK is bound by the convention to accept the rulings of the Strasbourg court when it's the respondent state. That's what was agreed back in 1950. But actually, the Strasbourg court can't force the UK to make that amendment. What happens then is one sees an incompatibility between UK law and its international obligations, and that's politically embarrassing for the government. So in reality, the UK has always amended its domestic law to bring harmony with the Strasbourg jurisprudence.
Ed Bates, that's the backdrop. How does the court itself work now? Robert Spano is a former president of the European Court of Human Rights, and he joins me down the line from Paris. Robert Spano, how does someone get to bring a case before the ECHR?
A person who feels him or herself aggrieved at national level must bring cases before the national courts. When all proceedings in the national court have ended, that person can bring an application before the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg alleging a violation of the convention.
And does the court hear many cases? I suppose I'm asking, is there a high threshold in terms of what the ECHR will hear?
Well, remember, David, that the court's jurisdiction extends to 46 European states, every state in Europe except Russia, Belarus, and Vatican City. So it's a jurisdiction of 660 million people. The court decides about 40,000 cases every year. If your case is lacking in merit, it will be declared inadmissible immediately. Probably about 90% of cases will not get through the first filtering mechanism.
So who actually appoints the judges?
The initial election is based on a list of three judges, which are nominated by each member state. But one of those three is ultimately elected. So there is one judge per state in the court. So 46 judges for 46 states. Judges decide cases in panels of 3, 7, and 17, and that is done by random selection.
Do the judges have anything to do with adjudications on cases about their own countries? In other words, if there's a case involving France, would the court ensure that a French judge sits on that case?
So when a case is dismissed immediately at the outset because it's lacking in any merit, that is done by a single judge who is not the national judge. But when it comes to all of the most important cases, which are decided by chambers of seven judges and grand chambers of 17, then yes, it is obligatory that the judge elected in respect of that state is on the panel. So in every important UK case or French case, you will have the UK judge or the French judge.
If you look at the record of the United Kingdom, as estimated by the number of cases brought and won against it in the European Court, is it a good or a bad record?
The United Kingdom is one of the convention's success stories. The UK has per capita the lowest number of applications in the Strasbourg Court. There are very, very, very few violations found in UK cases, and far fewer violations found compared to other similar states.
Now, can you give me a couple of examples of UK cases which might illustrate, in the first instance, the advantages to the UK of being inside the ECHR?
There are many examples. Two spring first to mind. The famous case from 1981, the case of Dudgeon versus the UK. In those days, male homosexual intimacy was a crime in Northern Ireland, and it had been a crime based on the law from 1885. There was no willingness to change the law in the United Kingdom. Public opinion was as it was. A man called Dudgeon went to Strasbourg, and Strasbourg found, in the famous case of Dudgeon versus the United Kingdom, that this was a violation of that person's private life, something we completely take for granted today. And there is even contemporaneous evidence demonstrating that the UK government at that time wanted the Strasbourg court to find in that manner because it feared doing it itself would create a backlash in public opinion.
That's a really interesting point you've made there, which it was useful for UK governments to have the ECHR do the thing that it itself was politically reluctant to do.
Exactly, David. And that is one of the main reasons that the European Convention on Human Rights was drafted. That is because often governments will be in a domestic political bubble where they will be afraid to protect human rights. We are applying an international control mechanism because often national politics is based on fear, prejudice, and distrust of the others. Another example that I can give you is the famous antique dealer case from Dorking. You had a young man called Malone, who all of a sudden was tapped by the police in the UK and was alleged to have been involved in fraudulent acts. What transpires is there was no law in the UK which allowed the police to wiretap people. And the courts in the UK said, well, we don't need a law. So long as it's not prohibited, it's okay. The Strasbourg court said, no, listen, if you're going to wiretap someone, you need a law passed in the national parliament. And that's what happened. Immediately after Strasbourg found a violation, the UK enacted its first Telecommunications Act, allowing the police to wiretap.
If the court decides human rights have been violated, is it the court's job to specify how that should be put right? Or is that a decision that is then put down to a national court or government?
Under the convention, it is not for the court to supervise how a judgment is executed. That is done by a political body called the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, which is composed of all the member states. So the UK representative in the Committee of Ministers is ultimately the foreign minister. So it is that body that supervises the execution of judgments. But it is always for the government in question, and it has flexibility to decide how it will execute a judgment of the court. And what good example is the final outcome of the prisoners' voting rights issue, which was ultimately executed by the UK government after years of procrastination, but it was based on a UK decision on the best manner in which that decision of the court was executed. And this was accepted by the Committee of Ministers.
And just to remind us, this was about the right of prisoners to vote in UK elections.
Yes.
In the case of the recent judgment which restricted the government's capacity to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, would that decision have been put before this committee of ministers at which the British Foreign Secretary or Foreign Office would have been represented?
If we're talking about the so-called Rwanda decision, the only thing that has happened there is that the European Court of Human Rights applied an interim measure prohibiting or limiting the government's ability to go ahead with the sending to Rwanda of the asylum seekers in question until the national UK courts had decided on the legality of the system. So the Strasbourg court has said nothing substantively about the merits or not of that system. That is now before the UK Supreme Court because, as you are aware, the Court of Appeal has found that the system violates the convention by a majority of 2-1. But let's assume for the sake of argument that the UK Supreme Court ultimately rules that as a matter of their view, the Rwanda system is okay, that it is legal. Well, then potentially the European Court of Human Rights will have a say. And if the European Court of Human Rights were then to find a violation on the merits, yes, the issue would go to the Committee of Ministers, and it would be for the member states, including the UK Foreign Secretary, who would have a say on how that judgment would be executed.
Now, let's say that happens, and they do deliver a judgment on how it should be executed. Would the UK then be bound by what they decided?
Yes. The UK government, under Article 46 of the Convention, has an international law obligation, which is without exception to abide by the rulings of the court. That is the decision the UK government, the UK Parliament, took when it ratified the convention. That is sovereign choice by the UK to abide by the international rule of law. You do not pick and choose what judgments you want to abide by. So therefore, the answer under international law is clear. Yes. The judgments of the court shall be respected by every member state.
Robert Spano, just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue. In the week that Number 10 has announced that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be visiting the UK in the autumn, you can listen to our recent programme asking whether we are entering the Saudi century, or the one about the state of Britain's rivers. Back to the ECHR, and I now want to talk about the consequences and politics of leaving it. Joining me in the briefing room are Dr. Joelle Grogan, a legal academic and senior researcher at the independent think tank UK in a Changing Europe, and Tom Hickman, Professor of Public Law at University College London. Tom Hickman, is politicians talking about leaving the ECHR a new phenomenon?
I think it is a new phenomenon for cabinet-level politicians to be supposedly thinking seriously about the issue. Obviously, it's been an issue that's been rumbling in the background for many years with dissatisfaction with the Human Rights Act, but it hasn't been thought of as a serious proposition.
Can you give us instances of where it's been raised in the past? I seem to remember the case of a Jordanian cleric back in the day.
Yes, so that's the case of Abu Qatada, who resisted deportation to Jordan for a number of years by relying on the fact initially that if returned to Jordan, he would be at risk of ill treatment there. And then after the UK obtained assurances about that, focus shifted to the fact that the evidence against him were two statements that appeared to have been obtained through torture. And he therefore resisted deportation on the basis that he would not get a fair trial. And he succeeded up to a point, although eventually the UK came to an arrangement with Jordan that the relevant evidence wouldn't be relied on. And in the end, he actually left voluntarily and then was acquitted, actually, in Jordan.
Let's now look at what we think the public's attitudes are towards staying or leaving the ECHR, because that could be one significant factor. Joelle, can you take us through what we know from polling and other evidence?
The latest poll that we can point to is by The Sun with YouGov in May of this year. So should we stay or should we go? Should the UK remain as part of the ECHR? 53% of respondents said we should remain. 27 said we should leave. But what's interesting is that it also breaks down on party lines. So 2019 Conservative voters, majority of them say that we should leave, about 55%. Whereas about 80% of Labour voters said that we should remain in the ECHR. What's important to underline about public opinion on the ECHR, and this is actually something that we share in common with every other country that is part of the ECHR, is the lack of public knowledge or awareness of what it is and what it means. So the way in which we frame questions about the ECHR really matters in public opinion.
Well, I was going to ask that very question. I mean, I don't know whether you know or not what the background information in the polling question was that was given to people so that they could make up their minds.
I did read it. It was, should we remain as part of the European Court of Human Rights? Now, obviously, you can't leave the court and stay as part of the ECHR, just like you can't leave the ECHR and remain part of the Council of Europe. They're all one and the same thing.
But I suppose, Tom, the question I'm getting at in the first instance is whether people knew whether what they were being asked was whether they should leave the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, or the European Court of Justice, the court which adjudicates at the EU level. Do we have any understanding at all whether people in answering that question for polls are aware of that distinction?
We know that there's a very high level of misunderstanding in the public at large, and indeed even in government, in parliament, and in all sorts of well-informed institutions, constantly muddling up the European Court of Human Rights with the European Court of Justice. So I suspect there may have been an element of confusion.
Well, let's take that then, Tom. We may not know for sure from the polls, but when we look at public debate, commentators, MPs and so on, what do you think about the level of understanding of the difference between the different courts is and what their functions are?
There's a significant difference between the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice. But I think the main difficulty is not a confusion between those courts. It's simply a confusion between what we could achieve if we were part of the European Convention on Human Rights and what we could achieve if we were not. That is to say, I think that people don't understand that leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, with all of the problems that that entails, including very serious diplomatic problems, wouldn't necessarily change the basic legal principles that are applicable to removing asylum seekers back to their home states or to third states like Rwanda. And there seems to be a very high level of confusion in public discourse, because it seems to be assumed that if one were to leave the European Convention on Human Rights, all of a sudden the UK would have a free hand to pursue the sorts of policies that it's been impeded in pursuing in the past.
Does that confusion extend to some Conservative MPs who seem to be suggesting that leaving the ECHR would solve the government's Rwanda problem?
It's pointing the finger at the European Convention on Human Rights as if that is the problem. All that's happened is the Court of Appeal so far, and it will go to the Supreme Court, has applied a principle which has been established for decades, which is that you shall not return a person to their home country where it would expose them to a risk of torture or treatment or death. And I think that politicians need to be clear whether they're really objecting to that principle, which would be very surprising, or whether what they're objecting to is our courts applying that principle. I find it difficult to understand and follow the argument because it seems to me that the principle is well established. It's been accepted by all governments up to this point, and it's still the policy of our government to accept that principle. And all that's happened is our courts have applied it.
So if withdrawing from the ECHR wouldn't solve the government's problem, namely being allowed to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, would they be able to get around it by withdrawing from the Convention on Refugees?
No, it wouldn't affect anything because the fundamental principle here is the principle that you shall not return an asylum seeker or refugee or any other person who's a non-national to a country where they would be unsafe or a country where they could be removed on to a country where they would be unsafe. And I'm using unsafe shorthand for torture and so forth. And that principle is found, as I've said before, in a number of treaties. And so you'd have to withdraw from the whole lot in order to free yourself from that principle, which is inconceivable. I mean, you have to ask the question, why on earth, really, would you want to free yourself from such a fundamental principle?
Joel, might some people not argue, well, we have the Human Rights Act in the UK. Why do we need to be in the ECHR at all? Isn't that a reasonable question to ask?
Let's first understand the relationship between the Human Rights Act and the ECHR. The Human Rights Act is how the ECHR works in the UK. The best way of understanding that is it's like the engine for the ECHR in the UK. If we left the ECHR but kept the Human Rights Act, it would be very like having a car with a very good British engine but no steering wheel. You cannot have the Human Rights Act without the ECHR. There's a separate question, which is if we withdrew from the Council of Europe, we left the ECHR, what would that leave us with in the UK? This presupposes nothing is done to replace it. We have no British Bill of Rights that tries to step in and replace ECHR rights. As a simple matter of law, the ECHR, with the rights that it lists, is the single document that we can point to in British constitutional law that lists all of these rights, that gives a body of protection to all of these rights. That's not to say that a common law, a UK common law, they don't otherwise exist. We have a right to fair trial, which is very keenly established in British law. But we would be left without a single human rights document if it is not replaced.
Is that because the Human Rights Act effectively points to the ECHR and says, that's what we're going to do, and doesn't actually itemise itself what a separate British notion of human rights is?
Exactly.
Do you take the talk of leaving the ECHR at all seriously?
If the UK were to leave the ECHR, it would immediately breach the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. There's no debate around that. The EU has also said that it will suspend cooperation on criminal law matters. What this means in practice is that courts in the EU will not recognise requests from the UK to extradite criminals or criminal suspects. The EU has said that and it's committed to that. So I think looking at public polling, looking at the major international consequences, looking at potentially domestic consequences and opening up the big can of worms of how do we protect rights in the UK without the ECHR, I don't think this is a vote winner. I don't think we're likely to see it seriously on a manifesto.
Joel Grogan there with Tom Hickman. My thanks to them and to Ed Bates and Robert Spano. And my conclusion, well, whatever the feelings about it, it seems hard to see any government deciding that it's actually in our national interest to leave the ECHR. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Diane Richardson and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Graham Puddyfoot. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I saw a footprint.
I'm Andrew Benfield and I'm obsessed with the Yeti.
The fist looks like some kinds of monkey.
The idea of a Yeti-like creature has been around for centuries, but could it be real? In Yeti, a new 10-part series from BBC Radio 4, I'm going to try to find out. I'll be joined by a good friend.
You said we were going for a short walk across the valley.
I'm Richard Horsey. This search isn't going to be easy.
They have the ability to disappear.
Are we chasing phantoms?
Yeti chasers will never find them.
But in this series, we think we might. Listen to Yeti on BBC Sounds.
What's there?
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.